Between 1971 and 73 in Rochester, New York, every parent's nightmare became reality. Three little girls were abducted, raped, and strangled to death. An odd pattern implied a link.
All the victims' first and last names started with the same initial. Their bodies were found in areas starting with that same letter.
I'm taking a fresh look at this bizarre cold case, the double initial murders. New clues are out there. I just have to find them. I'm M. William Phelps, best-selling crime author, and I have an obsession. Serial killer, cold cases.
Now, nearly 10 years later, investigators say they still need the public's help.
For me, it's personal. My sister-in-law was murdered, and her killer has never been caught. These killers are still out there. Their victims deserve justice. And just one new clue could make all the difference. I don't have a badge, but I do have something the cops don't have. Someone who understands the dark mind of a murderer.
Boy, I'm telling you, nobody can hear her scream.
Because he is one. I'm diving into a cold case with a serious history. Some top investigators have made solving these crimes their mission, but failed. So what can I bring to it? Fresh eyes, that's what. If I can find a new spin on old evidence, it could heat up the trail, and the families can get some closure. Their nightmare began on November 16th, 1971. It was late afternoon. Carmen Colon, age 10, was returning from the local pharmacy. She was well known in the Bull's Head area of southwest Rochester. Her extended family lived in the neighborhood. She never made it home. Her body was found 2 days later in a roadside ditch near the town of Chilai, 12 miles away. From bruising on her neck and body, it was determined she had been raped and strangled. The killer left no physical evidence at the scene, but he did leave a tantalizing clue to what would become his signature. The victims' names, Carmen Colon, and the town where she was dumped, Chilai, all start with C. Over the next 2 years, two more victims would follow the same pattern of rape, strangulation, and double initials. To get a psychological perspective on this killer, I'm meeting with John Kelly, a veteran criminal profiler who's well acquainted with sick minds.
Got another hot one here for you to help me with. It's very disturbing, however, you know? What kind of guy has sex with little girls and then kills them?
Well, what we're looking at is a monster, obviously. The question is, what makes this monster tick? It's a complicated sexual phenomenon. I mean, somewhere in their childhood, they've been abused, or the majority claim they've been abused. And somewhere, there's been a fusion of sexual stimuli and kids.
All right, so if it's a mental condition, why kill these girls then?
If they're dead, they can't testify against them.
Witness elimination? Is that it? Or does this guy enjoy the kill? Are we dealing with a pedophile who kills, or a killer first and a pedophile second? Maybe another dark mind would know the answer. For 10 years, Kelly's been working with a secret collaborator, an incarcerated serial killer he has codenamed 13. Through countless letters and face-to-face interviews, Kelly has looked deep into 13's disturbed mind and brought back answers that have put away other killers for life.
Please wait.
There's a part of me that just doesn't want to talk to him. There's a part of me that just gets a queasy feeling when I'm talking to him or corresponding with him. But then again, there's a part of me that will go to hell and back to catch the murderers of these children. And if it means shaking hands with the devil, I'll do it. This one's tugging at your heart.
Well, I'm telling you, this one really breaks my heart.
But is 13 really sad for the children or for the killer?
I feel he needs to start for companionship. Just wants to love these little girls.
Love? Try telling that to the families.
This man is frightened of women. He's probably sexually immature.
Right.
He's probably shy, gets nervous when he's talking to attractive women to the point where he stutters and he begins to sweat.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good chance he may not be well endowed. You know, there's...
Right.
Look, how can I say it? Picking on someone his own size. I think the killing is an afterthought. He doesn't want any witnesses. Because they begin to scream and make a lot of noise. He's forced to subdue them. That's it.
Could 13's sympathetic take on this killer be accurate? Is the motive to attack really some twisted form of longing for company? Somehow I doubt the victims' families share 13's compassion. I won't be talking to them in my investigation. They've suffered enough. Instead, I'm heading to Rochester to meet the four detectives who spearheaded the original investigations.
Rochester's an old mill town. Beer companies, old rundown buildings. You know, the wintertime, the snow coming off Lake Ontario. Highest street signs, that snow. It just keeps coming and coming. You know, in the summertime, salmon fishing in the lake, trout fishing in the streams. You know, between Albany and Niagara Falls, it's like a place I can stop and take a leak. That's what I think about Rochester.
But for these long-serving local cops, Rochester was once a highly prosperous, blue-collar community built on hard work and family life.
What I relate to most is that they just can't let this case go. You know, it's one of those things where when you're talking kids and murder, it's hard to just forgive and forget.
They're all retired now, but they haven't given up the hunt for this killer.
To rape and murder three young girls, it's a horrendous thing. It's bothered me, it's bothered Bob, it's bothered Nick, and it's bothered Beto.
These guys have chased leads and suspects as far as Puerto Rico, but it's time to pass the torch. They've promised to tell me everything they know, so I can take up the chase for this killer. Sal Ruvio, a detective with the Rochester Police Department at the time, tells me how it all began.
Well, I guess like most homicides started, there was a call that there was a body found outside the city, I think the initial one was, and I believe it was Carmen Colon.
Former Rochester PD detective Vito D'Ambrosio remembers going door to door searching for information.
We did a neighborhood check on top of the neighborhood check that the sheriffs did, and hoping that maybe we would know somebody in the neighborhood that might talk to us about seeing Carmen Colon the last day she was spotted.
That's when they learned about her last hours.
After school, she went home, which was on Romaine Street. From Romaine Street, she then went to visit her grandmother on Brown Street. Her mother had cooked a big pot of rice and corn. She got in the car with her uncle and they delivered this from Romaine Street to Brown Street.
Then she ran down the street to the pharmacy to get a prescription filled and never returned. In first victim, Carmen Colon's murder, Detective Bob Rosello tells me he had one guy locked in his sights.
I zeroed in on one suspect.
I received a call as to a person who was employed at a certain place in Rochester, a country club where he worked in the kitchen.
The kitchen worker was seen in Carmen's neighborhood, Bull's Head, the day she was murdered. Then, he fled right after the crime.
He had a room at the country club, and he got rid of his car. He left his property. He didn't pick up his paycheck, and he was gone.
Suspicious behavior by itself. Then Bob dug a little deeper.
And that led me to do some further investigation, where I found it was a time card, which is worked on an electronic machine when they punch in. And the time of the murder, it was penciled in.
Bob believes the suspect penciled in his shift at a later time to cover up for his absence. Then, there was the final straw.
And I got the background on him, and I got a hold of the police department in Mansfield, Ohio. And he had a warrant outstanding for his arrest for assault and child abuse on a 15-year-old girl.
Assault on a minor. It was all adding up. Bob was convinced he had a prime suspect. But his partner had other ideas. Nick DeRosa had developed his own person of interest, someone nobody wanted to suspect. Could Carmen's killer be a member of her own family?
She got in the car with her uncle. That's what made us look at him.
I'm in the middle of an upstate New York mystery. Who raped and murdered three young girls with double initial names?
There was a massive manhunt involving a small army of police, sheriff, detectives, and state police investigators.
After the first victim, 10-year-old Carmen Colon, was molested and killed, Detective Bob Rosello had a good suspect, a kitchen hand. But he fled Rochester right after the crime and disappeared. At the same time, his partner, Nick DeRosa, got a new lead. Eyewitnesses reported seeing a bizarre scene on a public road the day Carmen Colon disappeared.
They saw her running down a ramp and he backing down backwards. He was in reverse.
Did anybody see this person grab her again and take her into the car?
She was ahead of the car. She was running a little faster than the car was being driven.
Who was driving? And what happened next? All police know is it was the last time Carmen Colon was seen alive. Then, 2 days later, her body was found about a mile down the road, discarded in a ditch. That's where I'm going now, to see if it gives me any clues.
This is definitely it, the drainage ditch. First victim, Carmen Colon. Fractured skull, no pants, just a blouse, a sweater on. What her last moments must have been like. She should be skipping rope and playing board games with her friends. She's raped and strangled and left in a ditch. As she was screaming, running for help, nobody stopped to help her. But witnesses did provide one vital piece of information, a description of the car chasing Carmen. And it gave Detective Nick DeRosa a startling new person of interest. Carmen's own uncle, Miguel.
The car that was chasing her.
That's right, gray, small gray car. And he owned a gray car.
Then, more evidence emerged.
In her uncle's car, some of her hair was found. A doll that she owned was found in the back seat. And the car, which was new, we found out later that it had just been scrubbed clean. So that's what started us looking at the uncle, Miguel.
Law enforcement closed in on Carmen's uncle. And what happened? Just like the kitchen worker, Nick, suspect, fled.
First thing he fled was to Syracuse. We were half a step behind him. Syracuse told us he was in Spanish Harlem in New York City. We went to Spanish Harlem.
Nick DeRosa chased his guy all the way to San Juan, Puerto Rico. But the uncle was wise to him and fled into the jungle.
And I mean it was a jungle. No water, no bathrooms, no nothing out there. We couldn't find him.
Now two detectives, partners, were both left empty-handed. Had one of them let the killer slip through his fingers?
Bob, Nick, it sounds to me like you both think a different person killed Carmen Colon.
Absolutely.
Correct.
Bob and I go back to school in 1949. We were partners for a long time, but we do have differences of opinion.
Well, I had my suspect and he had his. And unfortunately, either one of us hit a home run. We're both batting the breeze right now.
Even the detectives who worked the case don't agree on a person of interest.
I mean, you think so strongly about what you have, and you make a lot of sense when you explain who your suspect is and why he committed a crime. But again, none of us have been surprised at other suspects we've had. It didn't even pan out or come close.
What neither of them knew then was that one of their suspects would eventually resurface and turn himself in. But not before a second defenseless young girl lost her life. April 1973, 11-year-old Wanda Walkowitz went to the grocery store on Conkey Avenue, just steps from her Avenue D home in the Upper Falls area of Rochester, 30 miles from where Carmen Colon went missing. She picked up a few things for her mother, paid for the groceries, and was never seen alive again. Parents all over Rochester were stricken with fear. Two young girls snatched in less than 18 months. Whose daughter would be next? But was it the same person who murdered Carmen Colon? Or worse, was another pedophile on the loose? Wanda's body was found at a remote rest stop off Route 104, 20 miles from where she was last seen. Would this site give investigators the physical evidence they'd been looking for? To find out, I'm meeting investigative journalist Gary Craig.
Hey, thanks for meeting me.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Craig recalls the fear and uncertainty of the time.
Parents who were scared to death for their children at the time, children who remembered the fear of their parents and remembered being, you know, kept in the household in a way they never had been before. I was amazed going back and looking at this case, you know, decades later, how so many people, it seemed to impact them, and it just continues to this day. It's like this case that nobody that lived here seems to ever forget.
Wanda's strangled body was found battered and bruised in this wasteland outside the town of Webster. Again, the victim's first and last names and the town share the same initial. This time, W.
So, I mean, this is where they found her, right here. Yes, the belief is he came from the city, did a U-turn on the highway, came back, sadly dumped her here, and then just headed right back into the city.
A human being, I mean, somebody's baby, just tossed out of a car like a piece of garbage.
Yeah, no care whatsoever.
So, I mean, what did you find out when you started digging in?
Yeah, I mean, probably sadly, like the police, we found out there were a lot of people who were suspects that probably didn't do the crime.
What's your gut tell you?
you know, it's really retracing the police stuff, but you know, the theory that it had to be somebody they know, maybe somebody in some position of authority that could get them into a car.
Wanda had been raped, but unlike Carmen's attack, this time, there was more than just bruising. The killer had left something behind.
We're talking about semen in the panties of one of the victims here.
Exactly, and you know, that's the evidence that they're sure that it would match if they found the right person.
In 1973, DNA profiling was at least a decade away. But police knew that in the future, science would catch up with this killer, and evidence like semen could solve crimes. So they stored the sample. Then, just 6 months later, another major development in the case. But it was the last thing anybody wanted. A third victim.
The body of 11-year-old Michelle Mayenza was found in Macedon.
And again, the killer left behind a tantalizing clue.
He wants them to be easily found.
The crimes took place between 1971 and 1973, and they struck fear in the hearts of parents.
I'm in Rochester, New York, reinvestigating the notorious double initial murders. By the fall of 1973, two little girls had fallen victim. Police had solid leads, even physical evidence, but no killer. Terrified parents feared the nightmare would never end. And they were right to be scared, because on November 26th, he struck again. 11-year-old Michelle Mayenza was the third victim of the double initial killer. Someone lured Michelle from the safety of her neighborhood after she visited a shopping plaza. Michelle was described as shy. Perhaps she was eager for a friend. Was it someone she knew, or someone who made her feel safe?
The body of an 11-year-old girl has been discovered in Macedon. Investigators fear Michelle Mayenza may be the victim of a serial killer.
Like Carmen and Wanda, Michelle had been sexually assaulted and strangled. Her first and last names and the town of Macedon where her body was found all start with the same letter, M. Now, I'm heading to the site.
So this is the Michelle Mayenza dump site. If someone would have blindfolded me and drove me here, I'd swear it was the Cologne site. It's almost identical. And why is he driving all the way out here, pulling off to the side of the road, dumping a body? These are the kinds of places he feels comfortable.
The killer appears to favor roadside locations to dump his victims. I'm thinking that's most likely because the roads give him easy access. All he has to do is pull over. But it also means the bodies are found quickly. Each of these girls was found within a day or two of her death. Why didn't the killer try to conceal his crimes?
What are you thinking?
I need to go back to profiler John Kelly. If he can't help, maybe his secret weapon 13 can.
So I'm out there in Rochester and I'm looking at these crime scenes. These bodies were easy to find. Why, Kelly?
That's the old dump and run, Matthew. You know how that works.
Right.
I mean, this guy's so fearful at that point in time because he's so vulnerable. He's riding around with a child in his car. What he needs to do is get rid of the evidence.
Not every killer dumps and runs. Arthur Gary Bishop, another pedophile killer, buried his victims deep in the Utah wilderness. Despite one of the biggest searches in Salt Lake County history, police didn't find the bodies until Bishop led them to a cluster of secret graves. According to my research, leaving bodies where they can be found is a specific behavior. It can mean you're an amateur, or that you're taunting law enforcement. The BTK killer, Dennis Rader, left his victims in their homes for police and family to discover. He even called in his kills. Ferrader, who also wrote letters to police and media describing his murders, it was all part of a need for attention.
Got her a glass of water, comforted her a little bit, and then went ahead and tied her up, and then put a bag over her head and strangled her.
He even suggested nicknames for himself, including the one that stuck, BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill. Is this killer like BTK? Calling out for publicity? Is that why the double initial victims were left where they could be found? Kelly has sent 13 the case files on these murders. Has something caught his eye that could help lead me to this killer?
Okay, John. After his crime, I think remorse sets in. He doesn't want anybody to know what sick, depraved thing he's doing. You know, killing 10, 11, 12-year-old girls, that's terrible. The area is full of wooded areas that he could place them someplace where they could never be found.
Right, you're right there.
Yeah. He wants them to be easily found. He doesn't want their bodies to rot or any more unnecessary harm come to them. That's it.
Again, I'm sickened by 13's bleeding heart for this monster.
What the hell is 13 talking about, remorse?
13 is explaining this guy's thinking after the fact. He's not defending him, Matthew.
Can a killer be empathetic toward his victims?
We're not just talking about a killer here. We're talking about a serial killer, okay? We're talking about a psychopath. The pure definition of a psychopath is they feel no remorse and they feel no guilt.
But if 13's right, this killer does feel guilt and shame.
So if we're gonna go by what 13 says, and this guy's remorseful, then he's showing empathy toward his victims.
If we go by what 13 says.
Why wouldn't we?
Well, he might be trying to manipulate us, Matthew.
Then why are we using him?
Because we have to sift through what's true, what's BS?
We're alchemists.
And what's the manipulation? That's playing mind games with a serial killer.
So far, 13's mind games have given me nothing but frustration. I need to go back to the sources I can trust, the cops who work this case. After the third murder in November 1973, there was still no sign of Bob Rosello's suspect, the kitchen hand, or of Nick DeRosa's guy, Carmen Colon's uncle. All four investigators tell me they were desperate for fresh leads. Then, 2 months after Michelle Meanza was killed, a new suspect came to light. Detective Vito D'Ambrogio says, in his mind, a local fireman was the best lead yet.
It was told to me that he had done service in the firehouses in the particular neighborhoods of all the girls. He was around St. Paul Street, which was Avenue D from Wanda Walkowitz. He was in Broad Street, which is close to Bull's Head for Carmen Colon. And he was on Goodman Street, which was near Mael Maenza when she was picked up on Webster Avenue.
And then this. On January 1st, 1974, police caught the fireman red-handed trying to rape a young girl in a garage. Was it a narrow escape for the double initial killer's fourth victim? Cops never got the chance to ask.
That he committed suicide in his car after being chased by the police officer.
The fireman's death eliminated the chance of a confession. But he did have a history of sexual attacks, and there were other reasons to connect him to the murders.
I thought the fireman was a relatively good suspect in light of the areas that he committed rapes. In fact, if I remember correctly, the last girl he attempted to rape was like 16 or 17 years old, and she looked like she was 9 years old.
After the fireman killed himself, the double initial murder stopped. And now I'm thinking, did the hope for justice die with him? I'm going back to meet again with journalist Gary Craig. He's no cop, but he tells me, in 1984, he began investigating a whole new suspect, someone already convicted of multiple murders. Is Kenneth Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, also the double initial killer? Bianchi is serving life in Walla Walla State Prison in Washington after he and his cousin killed 12 women in California and Washington in the late 70s. But it turns out, Bianchi also has a connection to Rochester. He had a job there that brought him into contact with children. He used to sell ice cream. Ice cream man. Great job for a serial killer, huh?
Yeah, sadly. Obviously, you get the children attracted to you.
It definitely fits the picture of a trustworthy charmer who could lure children from safety. But Bianchi maintains his innocence. And in a series of letters to Gary Craig, he has even launched a campaign to have his name removed as a suspect.
He's upset that his name gets mentioned with us. I mean, he's a narcissistic serial killer. That's who he is. And
it's kind of odd that a narcissistic serial killer wouldn't want to be connected to other killings, but when you look at it, it's the children that are involved.
I think perhaps even there's a level for him that he says he won't go to, and maybe this is it.
A serial killer's denial may not hold much credibility. Lucky for investigators, by 1985, new technology had become available that would expose the truth at last. And we're not talking about a polygraph. The semen sample left with the second victim, Wanda Walkowitz, was compared with Bianchi's DNA. But he's not the only suspect they compared it to. The fireman was also tested.
The body was exhumed. A sample was taken from the femur.
Two suspects, one test to find out who's guilty. But is there yet another question? Are we only looking for one killer?
My suspect is one case in itself, has nothing to do with the other two murders.
Experts at the time called the Rochester killer a psychopath with a growing appetite for this type of crime.
Who raped and strangled three innocent little girls in Rochester, New York in the early 1970s? These four detectives tell me they all had solid suspects, but no proof. Then, more than a decade after the murders, DNA testing was about to give them the answers they'd been waiting for. But would they be the answers they wanted? The fireman.
The body was exhumed. A sample was taken from the femur and proven to be negative.
Negative.
And the Hillside Strangler, Ken Bianchi. Negative.
Negative. So he's ruled out.
Eliminated.
Eliminated.
But then, one of the detectives finally got an unbelievable break. His suspect, who fled before he could be interrogated, suddenly reappeared and turned himself in. It's the first victim's uncle, Miguel Colon. Detective Nick DeRosa finally had his guy right where he wanted him. After a long interrogation, including a polygraph, would justice finally be served?
He flunked the lie detector test and...
He flunked the lie detector test?
Yeah.
Nick was convinced the uncle was guilty of at least Carmen's murder, but he couldn't connect him to the other two murders. Then, just as he was building his case, the uncle, like the fireman suspect before him, put a gun in his own mouth and fired. That left only Bob Rosello's suspect, the kitchen worker, to rule in or out. Police eventually tracked him down, 6 feet under.
They got the body located. He was dead, and he was in the cemetery in Mansfield, Ohio.
Did the kitchen hand also take vital information to his grave? Police only learned enough to know he wasn't in Rochester at the time of the second and third murders. And it all started adding up to one alarming conclusion for these weary detectives.
In my case,
Carmen Colon, with my suspect, is one case in itself, has nothing to do with the other two murders.
I feel the same way. I always felt that too. Miguel did his niece, but somebody else did the other two.
Were there two killers, or even three? And if there is more than one perpetrator, what about the double initial connection? Could what has always been thought of as the signature of this killer be nothing but a coincidence?
So, Bob, Nick, do you think the initials were a coincidence?
I believe it was. I think it was just a stroke of luck. In my opinion, totally coincidental.
We had another homicide after that, and it was a double initial. And everybody first jumps right to the conclusion, we got another double initial. Well, this was different than the other ones. The other ones were abducted, murdered, and dumped elsewhere. This one was at her home, and it turned out to be the maintenance man of the apartment.
And whoever killed these three victims?
He didn't go after those girls because they had the same initials.
Hollywood couldn't come up with all the twists in this case. We've got four suspects: family, fireman, dishwasher, serial killer. They're on the run, committing suicide, being dug up from graves to be DNA tested. They're failing polygraphs, dying with secrets. And now, the whole double initial thing is supposed to be a false lead too? I'm thinking this case needs a completely new perspective. I want Kelly to call 13 one more time.
This double initial thing, the cops seem to think maybe that it's just a coincidence. It's not true.
See, I disagree with that. I disagree with that because of the percentages and the odds of having three girls with double initials murdered in the same area and dumped near towns or in towns starting with the same initial. Matthew, I believe there's too many similarities. I believe when you look at these girls, when you look at the ages, when you look at the areas, when you look at the homes they've come from, I'll tell you, I have a real problem with believing that they're not connected.
There are other similarities that get lost in the double initial hype. The girls all came from broken homes. They were all Catholic. They all had learning disabilities. And they were all abducted in late afternoon.
For me, there's much more than just the double initials. What I'm looking at in a profiler is the obsessive compulsive behavior that I'm seeing here.
Someone with obsessive compulsive traits is driven by repetitive thoughts, compelled to act. Mostly, this behavior is harmless. But in this case, Kelly believes the killer's fixations are deadly, and he should know, because he says 13 is driven by the same urges. But does 13 really want to help us catch someone like him? And if so, why?
13 says that he does it because he's a new man. He's not the old 13. And he wants to try and help get these psychopaths like himself off the street. He wants to help society, is what he tells me.
Let's see if he's serious.
You know, it's my feeling that the killer was well aware of the children's names.
13 agrees with Kelly. The letters mean something to this killer. Do they mean something special to 13, too?
No, it's the CWM for Carmen, Michelle, and Wanda. Could that be the killer's initials?
Right.
What I did is I took the alphabet, and I put his one, B is two, C is three.
Right.
So on. And I come up with 3-13-23.
Is this mind games again? Or is 13 for real?
And then since the double initials right here, once I doubled that,
right,
the 62646 would make him a Cancer, and he would have been 25 years old at the time.
You're working overtime on this one.
Well, yeah, I just let my mind run wild on that. That's it.
What was that about?
Yeah, that was weird.
The astrology
stuff? Yeah, I don't even know where that
came
from.
Like he's cracking a code, a safe.
Yeah,
you know, 3-13-23. What the hell was that?
Yeah.
But the thing is, I don't think 13 was messing around. I think he believes that stuff. And if he does, then maybe the double initial thing isn't so far-fetched either. Still, I want another perspective from someone who's actually put a serial killer behind bars. Frank Adamson commanded the task force that brought down the Green River Killer, a man convicted of killing 49 women in Washington in the 80s and 90s. What does Frank have to say about this case? Does he agree with his fellow officers that the double initials are just a coincidence?
Well, I think that's certainly possible, but I do think you have to at least entertain the idea that he might be qualifying these victims.
Frank's agreeing with 13's take, not the cops. What about Carmen being murdered by someone else?
It's certainly possible to take Carmen Colon out, but I wouldn't take her out. It's highly unusual to have pedophiles out killing their victims. What I'm saying is that you don't have someone killing a child every day. So it's always possible that you have a second pedophile, but I doubt it in this case.
There are so many opinions on this case, it's hard to keep them all straight. But the bottom line is that three little girls never got to grow up.
You know, the sounds. Baseball hitting a bat. Kids yelling and screaming. Those three girls should have had that. Who is he? Did he hang out in a park like this? Did he stalk those girls without them knowing, sitting there on a park bench, drinking a soda, eating popcorn, laughing, knowing that he was gonna put his hands around their necks and rape them? He did that. I know he did that. Hell, there could be a guy just like that here right now, and nobody would know.
And then, something even more unbelievable happens. If my police contacts say the double initials are just coincidence, how can they explain this?
In a strange echo of the Rochester murders, the first and last names of the victims here in California also begin with the same letters.
Some believe the so-called double initial murders of Rochester in the 1970s are not connected, just coincidence. But now, breaking news is forcing them to think again.
Police in Rochester, New York are now sharing their information with Marin County after investigators here noted what they're describing as eerie similarities between the two sets of murders.
April 2011. A man has been arrested in Marin County, California, for crimes that mirror the Rochester double initial murders. The defendant is a photographer. We can't reveal his identity because he hasn't gone to trial yet. But police allege he killed four young women with double initial names in California between 1977 and 1994. They were strangled and their bodies dumped in rural locations, just like the Rochester double initial murders. And it doesn't end there. The suspect lived in Rochester in the 1960s and 70s and was in the area at the time of the murders. And one of his alleged victims out in California was also called Carmen Colon. Identical to the first victim in the Rochester case. But the match isn't complete. The victims were older than the Rochester girls. So,
what do the former investigators of the Rochester case make of this new suspect?
His victims were in their 20s. Doesn't sound like he would be interested in girls 10 or 12 years old. That's just my opinion.
These four veterans want this case solved more than most. And yet, they're not buying it's the same killer. But what about the double initials? And another victim named Carmen Colon. How can they not be connected?
Carmen Colon is a very common name in the Puerto Rican community. From New York to California, thousands. And that could be the answer.
I'm thinking, there's gotta be a better answer than that. And then, it occurs to me. Are these guys downplaying the new suspect because they don't want to get their hopes up? Only to have them dashed again, like so many times before? I guess, after almost 40 years of frustration, I try not to get my hopes up either.
Sal, throughout this, I've noticed something. And I've noticed it with the other guys. There's a bit of sadness that has come over you.
Well, it's hurtful because when you investigate a major crime like that, you get to know the victims and know a lot about them, and you always make a connection with your own relatives and your own children, you know? I do take it personally, and it's pretty hurtful to see this happen to children.
What would it mean for the police department and the community to solve this case?
Mean an awful lot to the policemen that put a lot of hours in and to the families who deserve some closure.
But how could it be solved?
There's no doubt in my mind that somebody knows something. And if they're going to take that information that they have to their grave, well, there's someone at a higher authority who they'll have to face someday.
California and New York authorities are still investigating whether the suspect being held in Marin County could be responsible for the Rochester murders. But they will need more than the circumstantial evidence they have to bring charges against him. This 40-year mystery has taken its toll on everybody who's ever touched it. Cold cases stay cold because people keep secrets or hide a piece of evidence that could be the missing link. With your help, the double initial murders can still be solved.